Today on The Nose, our weekly cultural roundtable, can I ask you a question? How come these days the distinguishing through line for every three topics is Trump? Obviously, Aretha Franklin leads the list of topics, but now we have President Trump's announcement that one of her big accomplishments apparently was that she worked for him three times. She also refused to sing at his inauguration. Onward to Omarosa. Of course, there's no way to talk about Omarosa without talking about Trump. And then we move from there to Spike Lee's movie, Black Klansman, in which we actually see Donald Trump towards the end, and conversations occur among the characters about Donald Trump. There is no getting away from this man, particularly when you're talking about race in America. And his classic appeals to white grievance always make him front and center of these conversations. But frankly, I'm tired of him. The news is next.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong. Take me for granted, leaving love unsure. Makes willpower weak and temptation strong. Should understand she's not just a plaything, she's flesh and blood just like her man. If you wanna do
presumably, I don't need to tell you who that is. Presumably, also, you may have heard so many tributes and analyses that you might not be ready for one more here on The Nose. But there's no way we can do a cultural roundtable at the end of this week and not talk about Aretha Franklin and her passing. You know, I just also want to say there's something that needs to be said about like how fast that kind of thing happens now. The Slate Culture Gabfest actually eulogized Aretha on Wednesday when she was still in hospice care. And, of course, Terry Gross can always get a show on the air with her you know, back catalog. So, boom, by tomorrow she had a great Aretha show. So it's hard. It's hard to, you know, I mean, the New York Times did an amazing job today and actually kind of blew out the cover of its weekend section with just a gigantic photo of Aretha, and obviously a huge Wesley Morris piece on the front page. Anyway, we're not going to be any different from anybody else, and it's everybody has to process this, and so you're going to get to hear our panel process it. And our panel is Rich Holland, Principal and Design Director at CoLab and a Commissioner on Cultural Affairs for the City of Hartford. Tanisha Dugan, a Producing Assistant at TheaterWorks. You also will be able to see her and hear her on the panel of Asking for a Friend, Wolfie's sort of question and answer advice show at CT Improv tomorrow at 7 p.m. And Arayan Richards Cooper, a contributing editor at Commonweal, and writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine. So, you know, Rich, as we were, Jonathan was asking what to open the show with, and I just said that song, and it turns out to be, I think you have the take on it that I have too. This is just one more example of this woman just making two or three genres flow together at the same time.
Yeah. So, I've always been fascinated what makes America America, you know, and luckily we're going to be talking about a couple of those things today. And one of them is a voice and a spirit like Aretha Franklin. The work that she was doing seems like it's rooted in R&B, it's rooted in gospel, it informs pop, it informs just about everything that is American music, and does it with a kind of grace and an unsullied way. You know, she could be singing a sexy song and it still doesn't feel dirty. It feels, you know, like blessed by God. And so, you know, that's Aretha to me.
All right. I don't know. Tanisha, where did your thoughts go when you realized we were going to talk about Aretha Franklin?
Many places. First, in an effort of R-E-S-P-E-C-T, I should clarify that my title over at TheaterWorks is producing associate and not assistant, only because I know it was a slip of the tongue.
I actually misread
only
it, yeah.
Because, yeah. Completely. But it was like the perfect doorway, so I had to walk through it. Because I think it's important what she did and who she was is an embodiment of a woman like me. When I see these photos splash on the cover of these newspapers and in my Instagram feed and across my social media, I see a black woman that has no real connections to European beauty, and that amazes me and awes me and excites me. And we are far away from that if we're being honest about what our pop stars, what our superstar singers look like. But she reminded, especially as we're looking at these sort of older photos of her back in her quote-unquote heyday, and a reminder that women like her, like me, are worthy and essential and at the centerpiece of the culture that we call America and American culture. So that's where my mind is today.
All right, Randa, you know, I'm the old guy on this show, but I think you might be the second oldest
guy.
I'm
pretty close.
Yeah. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and I think I even sent it around to you guys very early on, is it right around the time that Aretha passed, was her performance of the Star Spangled Banner at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. I am old enough to remember seeing that and hearing that and watching my parents' reaction to it, watching America's reaction to it a little bit. I was about 14 at the time. We're going to play just a little bit of that for you right now, and then I want to talk to you a little bit about sort of what she was right around that time too. So there's actually, when you listen to that, there's not a lot of, I mean, there's gospel improvisation in it because that's the tradition she comes out of. And in gospel music, you improvise the most sacred songs that you're going to be singing. But America still hadn't heard anybody sing. This is a year before Hendrix. It's a little bit before Marvin Gaye, I think. America hadn't heard anybody sing the national anthem in a black idiom at all, and not everybody liked it. But it was an introduction, I think, for a lot of white Americans to even what raw gospel music sounded like. Mahalia Jackson always, you know, tried to classicize gospel music as much as she could. I don't think anybody ever mainstream maybe hadn't heard anybody sing like this.
Yeah, and in that way, I think it was kind of a game changer. Anyone who's tried to sing the Star Spangled Banner knows that it's melodically pretty intimidating. It doesn't lend itself that easily to singing in any way. But the traditions of it were martial, and that goes back to the martial inception of the melody. It's interesting to me to note that Marvin Gaye, who sang a series of different versions of the Star Spangled Banner, sang one that year. He sang it pretty straight, not really much going on with his version of it in 1968. By 1983, he's doing that famous version of it at the NBA All-Star Game where, you know, it sounds like sexual healing. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that not only did Aretha produce a rendition that was a game changer, but it also showed, and so many different songs that she sang showed this, how powerfully transformative her voice was. I mean, basically, she could take almost anything and she would turn it into an Aretha rendition of it. And that was true when she sang America the Beautiful at Obama's inauguration. It was true in 1998 at the Grammys when she filled in for Luciano Pavarotti, who was sick, and she sang a Puccini aria. It's intensely moving, you know, to hear that. She had that ability.
It's all right. So interesting because
actually, just so we don't break that, it might be worth letting people hear a little bit of that. The Puccini aria is Nessun Dorma from the final act of Turandot. Here's a little bit of that.
Oh, praise, then share.
All right, Tanisha, what were you going to say?
And actually kind of reveals itself in a little in this song as well, but kind of going back to your point, Colin, about that tension between what she was singing, what it feels like America was ready for or wanting, you can actually hear in that last recording that, for me, as it was going on, you started to hear the crowd singing the rendition of the anthem the way they knew it. And it was beautiful, really, to hear her embrace that and then ride it and use it as sort of accompaniment to where she's going. And you can feel that connection as you listen to the chorus and this version as well. That's amazing, and that the beauty of that tension she was able to bring in real time to that song as it was happening is amazing.
And I'd have to say that's a big heart of the beauty of Aretha Franklin is that she didn't throw stones at the wall. You know, she just sort of massaged them out of the way. I was listening to a recording this morning where she was leading a group of folks to a tribute of a Carole King song. And I think on the stage was Aretha in the center, where she belongs, and flanked by, let's see, Gloria Estefan, Mariah Carey, Celine Dion, Shania Twain, and Carole King. And, you know, everybody did their best, you know, and it seemed as though the other folks had leads to do, but they were humbled, clearly. You know, these divas were humbled in the presence of this woman's fluidity and just sort of stood back and let her really be the center. And she did not crowd people out. It was just the inevitability of how she moves with it. And I think that there's an element of that that is specifically Black.
That's what I think is so amazing about that rendition of the anthem is that she did not crowd the crowd out. Mm-hmm. And so many times you hear other divas sing that song and then the crowd begins to join and they do everything they can to fight against what the audience is doing. And as it went on, you actually heard the crowd singing more, not in defiance against what the style in which she was bringing to the song, but almost as if they were buffeted and winged by this voice that was saying, come on.
It was kind of call and response at a certain point.
Yes.
They're singing, then she's kind of singing behind the beat a little bit. Just to talk a little bit about that versatility, too. And I think the other thing that, Rich, I hear you saying, this is a woman who, you think of her as a diva. But in fact, unlike a lot of divas, she actually was a pretty good band leader, a kind of person who understood arrangements from the get-go. I was listening to her be interviewed by Terry Gross yesterday and talking about arrangements from the American Songbook and who was good at them. And that was from day one. Obviously, she was no slouch at the piano. Just to sort of showcase that a little bit, let's hear her. And this is pretty early in her career, sing the Johnny Mercer Hoagy Carmichael tune Skylark.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring? Where?
You know, Rand, once again, you see, hear this incredible fusion that Rich talked about at the beginning. There's this kind of Eddie Arnold, Ray Charles country piano going on in the background, and then these kind of shimmering right. Nelson Riddle. It wasn't Nelson Riddle arrangement, but Nelson Riddle type strings here. And then this woman, you know, really, once again, fusing gospel, jazz, blues, you know.
Well, exactly. Yesterday when I heard the NPR appreciation of her, they had a tape of her singing at age 14. Mm. And the power of the voice of that 14-year-old, recognizably, obviously, her voice, really blew me away. She lived a life that was a kind of template for black musicians in the mid-20th century. She had a gospel background. Her father, as you know, was a well-known pastor who was an associate of Martin Luther King. She was from Detroit. And that movement from a religious-based music to secular and popular music is a, you know, a well-known template, but it's one that allowed her and other singers with that background to endow whatever they sang with a certain, you know, kind of transposed religiosity. The song, we all chose songs of hers, and the song that I chose that we'll play later on is the Burt Bacharach song, I Say a Little Prayer. I'm an enormous Dionne Warwick fan. I love Dionne Warwick, and there was something about the crystalline, light quality of her voice that was just perfect for Bacharach. But I love hearing Aretha take that song, the Queen of Soul meets the Prince of Schmaltz, and she takes that Bacharach song, and she just rocks it completely.
Yeah. And let's not forget the Prince of Schmaltz. And let's not forget the kind of businesswoman she was. I mean, she's infamous for the pocketbook, you know. Mm-hmm. She would not sing until you paid her. And then she put that money in her pocketbook. And that pocketbook never left her side, which is just fantastic and wonderful and diva-ish and delightful and that might purposeful way.
That might lead us to 1985 when, in fact, not that Aretha could ever become irrelevant. She was the Queen of Soul. You don't lose that title. But music was changing. Musical idioms were changing. New stars were coming to the forefront, and there was a sense in which she was a little bit less canonical and essential, at least in a very present way, for a few years. And by the way, Wolfie, we're going to number five here. And then we got this. And there was this sense that if you were going to be dancing in 1985, you better be dancing to Aretha. And she had kind of laid down that marker once again. Kind of, you know.
What's crazy to me is knowing that that's 1985, because I don't know why that song is like in my bones, but it's something about like the three-year-old body that held on to that song. Because like I shouldn't connect to that song, but it is like I know that song like it came out in 1996 and I was conscious, but I was not.
One thing that I want you all to talk a little bit about, okay, I just have to sort of vomit out this thing that's really, you know, I wish I didn't even have to say it, but President Trump today, in the course of allegedly paying homage or tribute to Aretha Franklin, apparently her distinguishing characteristic as far as he was concerned was that she worked for him many times. This seems not even really to be true in any real sense, but I mean that notion anyway, that would be what was important about her is part of his huge, huge pathology. But I would argue that the arc of Aretha Franklin's career begins, you know, in those very early years as this virtuosic singer. And it kind of reaches where it needs to go. It reaches its angle of repose at the inauguration of Barack Obama and with the ascendancy of Barack Obama to the presidency. But there's a musical way that Jonathan and I wanted to make that point, and we're going to do it now.
Reservoir of goodness, beyond and of another kind, that we are able to do each other in the ordinary cause of things. That reservoir of goodness. If we can find that grace, anything is possible. If we can tap that grace, everything can change. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I was. So that's Barack Obama obviously singing at the Charlotte Observance, the post-Charlotte Observance, a really remarkable moment. And of course, prior to that was one of the older versions of her singing that same song. And to me, Rich, this, you know, I really wanted to do this because the Charleston Observance. I wanted to do this because when I started thinking about that connection, I started thinking about that song. She had two or three famous versions of Amazing Grace. And I regarded the moment where Barack Obama sang that song at the Charleston Memorial as one of the most amazing things I've ever seen a president do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Take it from there.
And he knew the words.
Yes.
Unlike some others. I don't know what to do with that, Colin, other than I was like half in tears listening to this. So I'm a little sort of like emotional right now.
People have been crying on this show all week.
Oh, really? Yeah. All right. Then add me.
Yesterday
to the
was
list.
Me, so go ahead. I can hand it off to the show.
No, I got it.
Oh, you got it. Okay.
Grace has a discipline. And I think that that's a thing that so many folks are forgetting right now and that Aretha Franklin stood for. There was a show that I'd watch. I'd popped into the middle of the darn thing. And so I don't even know what the show was, but Aretha was on it. And there were these kids that wanted to learn that were singing, and they wanted some tips from Aretha. And, you know, and she wanted to strip away, you know, the fashion. She wanted to strip away the now and help them connect to the discipline of being ready to share all of who you are, all of your grace, and all of your willingness to love. Through your voice. I think that that's true of her. I think that that's true of Obama, absolutely. It's these folks who have this understanding of the syncopation and the spaces between things, you know, and how full and vibrant and poignant those spaces are and would give the emptiness back to people in a way that's incredibly full. And I can't listen to this and not just be grateful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be hard to top that. But Tanisha, I did feel like reading the tributes and thinking about this today and thinking, as Rand said, about the fact that, you know, she had a childhood connection to Martin Luther King. There's this path that she walked on, that the music – that she sang was interpreted lots of different ways. But one of the ways that, for example, Respect ultimately was interpreted was, you know, in a different way maybe than Otis Redding had intended it, maybe a different way than she intended it. But it was very much – she became part of the story of progress and of a job that never really ends. But part of the job may have ended for her at the moment Obama took the White House.
Yes, and I too started listening to that last clip and got emotional and then really pulled myself together quickly because I thought to myself, this was the moment that terrified and angered so many white Americans, that this grace, which is disciplined, being put out as the dominant thing, not by them but by us, was and is terrifying. And I think to connect it back to the anthem, to connect it to back to the way in which she used black culture, which is American culture, in a way that was front and center to all of America, is a through line, is a story that continues, is the story that we'll continue as we continue our conversation in other areas and sectors today. And I wonder and puzzle over that point of disconnect, because as we'll talk about when we get to the movie we saw, there's something deeply religious about our country, and yet when it is in the hands of Aretha and Barack, it is not the same.
All right, I'm getting told that we've got a break. And so just to have time to talk about Black Klansman, which is the movie I don't know if I even mentioned that Black Klansman is the movie we're going to talk about. So we have to stop there. What we're going to do is go out with Rand's number one pick. That is indeed that Bacharach song, I Say a Little Prayer.
Come in my hand now, and wondering what dress to wear now.
And yes, fanboys, that was Betsy Kaplan doing the break. People got excited here in the studio, hearing Betsy Kaplan do the break. All right, so
it's true.
Yeah, it's, you know.
I am.
We're all fangirls.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to switch gears here. We thought we were going to talk about Omarosa, but unless we can wedge it into our conversation about Black Klansman, we're not going to probably get there. I think maybe it might be for the best, although – I don't know. I've had some interesting thoughts about her over the last few days. And there are ways in which she fits into the narrative we're talking about. But anyway, let's go do what we know we're going to talk about. We all went to the movies this week to see Black Klansman, directed by Spike Lee. Let's start off with a little clip from it. You're going to hear Adam Driver as Flip Zimmerman, a white undercover cop, and John David Washington as Ron Stallworth, the lead role in this movie. He is a new black undercover cop. What you need to know is that he has infiltrated the Klan just using his voice on the phone. But there's a problem, obviously, if he has to meet his, quote, fellow Klansmen, unquote, in person. He can't do that. And that's where Adam Driver comes in, and you'll hear a little bit of the tension that's going back and forth between them about that.
I didn't want to say we're trapped, but that Peckerwood had a gun in my face. And he was an ass hair away from pulling the trigger.
And he didn't.
But he could have. And then I would have been dead. For what? Stopping some jerk-offs from playing dress-up?
Flip, it's intel.
Well, I'm not risking my life to prevent some rednecks from lighting a couple sticks on fire.
This is the job. What's your problem?
That's my problem. For you, it's a crusade. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a job. It's not personal, nor should it be.
Why haven't you bought into this?
Why should I?
Because you're Jewish, brother. The so-called chosen people. You've been passing for a WASP. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, cherry pie, hot dog, white boy. That's what some light-skinned black folks do. They pass for white. Doesn't that hatred you've been hearing the Klan say, doesn't that piss you off?
Of course it does.
Then why are you acting like you ain't got skin in the game, brother?
Rookie, that's my business.
It's our business. Now I'm going to get you your membership card so you can go to the cross burning and get in deeper with these guys.
Right, partner?
All right. So, Tanisha, I find this is a hard movie to talk about just because so many things are going on in it. Stylistically, Lee is trying on about 18 different styles, throwing the kitchen sink at us and evoking styles of the past. But there's also quite a bit of comedy and quite a bit of tension and quite a bit of political consciousness in this movie. So I don't know. What did you get most in touch with here, I guess, is maybe a way to put it.
I don't know. The bad thing is that what you've done to me just now is put me in sort of I'm thinking about a playwright that I've been following lately who is doing the exact same thing, which is throwing the kitchen sink in. And I'm wondering if this is an aesthetic that we're in right now. Mm. So I just want to like parking lot that for my brain for later. I think he's being purposeful in how many genres he's throwing in here. I think they are mostly, quote unquote, the black genres or genres that you would find if you're looking at black movies, which is just an interesting thing for me to think of in this, like this weekend with Crazy Rich Asians opening and it not playing that game at all. And I think there's something about sort of black auteurs that feel like they need to pay homage and to comment as they make their work. But this movie is about commenting on. I mean, there's no way to get around the point of this without that. So that's a bit of rambling. What does strike me, though, listening to this on the radio, and something that caught me while I was watching it, too, is how much David sounds like his father and how interesting that is as like this idea of actors as family business. And I don't think there is another family. The Poitiers didn't actually produce another Sydney, so that Denzel has done that and that he's so fantastic. And as Spike said, he told him he was going to do this movie. He looked at him and said, I knew you before you were born, so you will be doing this. It's all interesting stuff for me.
Well, Rand, if we could stay with the style thing for a second, and I think to Tanisha's point, one way to talk about that style is postmodernism. I mean, there's a way this movie begins with footage from Gone with the Wind. It ends with news footage. In between, there are very strong evocations of blaxploitation films and a lot of different styles being played with, some camera tricks I've never seen before. There's that dissolve. It's not even a dissolve. There's a way these kind of faces move in and out of light at certain points. I guess what I made out of this is a story that's so complicated and frustrating to tell that I'm not going to just tell it one way. I'm going to use a whole bunch of conventions and kind of mush them together. I think you called it kind of a roller coaster ride or something like that.
Well, you know, you made a comment in one of our emails that you found it difficult to have a sort of consistent set of emotions throughout the film. And that comment made me think of the film 12 Years a Slave. And the way in which 12 Years a Slave works on an audience is to bring you into this sort of emotional vice grip of horror. And you're going to have a consistent set of emotions that's going to deepen. And that film, which is obviously about the horrors of slavery, is intended to bring you into a vicarious sense of those horrors. This film doesn't work that way. This is a film of ideas. And it's a film that is very much about commenting on ways in which previous ideas have been laid out and commented on. It would be hard to overestimate the importance to this film of the film Birth of a Nation, a film that really is sort of the text of American racism, and also a film that Spike Lee knows, as great film student and film geek, is really a foundational film of American cinema. The Birth of a Nation, which I will admit I had never watched in entirety. I'd seen bits and pieces of it, D.W. Griffith's film of 1916. So I went back and watched the whole three-hour thing. And I'm just very interested in the way in which Spike uses this film to take on that film. And he does it in ways that are structural. He does it in ways – there's a great scene, and this is the last thing I'll say about this. We can develop it if we want to. But there's a scene toward the end of this film when Washington's character is spying in a room where the Ku Klux Klan is watching Birth of a Nation. So we are watching a film in which a black man is watching a bunch of white racists watching a film that is sort of the foundational film of white racism. So there are levels of sort of controlling the narrative of structural play on the question of narrative and who controls it. And that's very ambitiously and deftly done in this film.
I had a completely different experience. The idea that this film was all over the place emotionally and there wasn't anything to hang on to, I hung on to this thing emotionally from the very beginning, from pretty much the first scene. It felt like this is my narrative, and it felt like a prompt to what am I going to stand for, and what I'm, and what's the work that I'm going to continue. And I even echo back to the montage that you were talking about, Colin, where these Afro-black faces were floating through and their hair disappeared into the background completely. So you couldn't even tell that they were Afros, but you knew that they were there. Those were images from my childhood. They were the Black is Beautiful posters. When I see them in this context, it's not just an homage. It's a question about, you know, where have you been lately and what have you stood for? And that's a thing that has to be answered. So to me, this was one of Spike's most masterful movies yet. Mm-hmm. It's the one that I really kind of championed because it all, to me, all of it, held together. For all of the devices that he threw in, they stimulated something in me that's like, oh yeah, I remember this. I remember the joy of Soul Train. I remember, you know, all of the stuff. I remember that period, you know, where we went for joy and forgot the discipline. Mm-hmm. You know, so it all echoed something, you know, very resounding for me.
I just quickly wanted to say about that emotional thing, and I don't know if anybody else had this experience, but I mean, there are so I saw the movie in Bloomfield. It wasn't a very big audience, but I think probably there were more Black people in the audience than white people in the audience. I walked in with a Black couple, and there are moments where this is just a really funny movie where he's going for laughs and he gets laughs. But there were a couple of times where I laughed and I didn't hear a lot of echoes of laughter around me. And I thought, well, that was clear. Have we moved into a part of the movie where that's not funny anymore? And I think he's got his – running his thumb down that knife's edge so much that at times anyway, I wondered if I was exactly in step with where I was supposed to be.
I think I had the reverse experience of you. I went and saw it in a mostly white audience and a really full audience. And when I bought my ticket, I thought – in this new world of movie buying where you buy your ticket and you can see where you're going to sit, and it looked empty, I thought I was going to be one of five people in the audience. And when I got there and it was full and there were only six of us being Black people in the theater, I was literally – I had that – this sounds awful. I was terrified that this was going to end up in a mass shooting. Like, this was my thought as I sat in this – theater, because I just could not wrap my brain around why this audience full of white people wanted to see the show. And then as the movie was going on, I realized, to your point about you laughed at the time that no Black people were laughing, and I'm sure the Black people felt comfortable because of the audience to respond honestly, that none of us was having an authentic response to this movie because it had become performative for everybody in the room. And I think there's something interesting about what Spike is doing, because I actually think there is a white experience of this movie and there is a Black experience of this movie. And like America, the twain will not meet at this moment. And I bristled at the idea of ambition when you said that about his work right now, because he is like a granddaddy of film right now. And he is making very specific choices about this film. This is not like, let me try this out. Oh, this 32-year-old.
I wasn't saying that.
No, it actually came from Rand when he was talking about sort of the layers in which he's using the art form when he's looking at Birth of the Nation. And I think, as I heard you guys talk, there's actually something meta about all of the devices. And it made me think of the question we've talked about frequently in America about melting pot versus soup with all of its components intact. And there's something about this movie being a soup with all of its components intact that I think he's playing with all of these different genre flavors and tastes.
But to your point, though, I just want to echo that I think that they're intact for different people.
Yes.
You know, and yes. For me, I walked away with it very intact. But it was also my experience.
Mm-hmm.
For me, from my experience, when I see any film, especially a film that combines different modes like this, and it really does. I mean, it starts out with that sort of crazed bit of with Alec Baldwin as this possibly 1950s eugenicist with this racist screed, with Birth of the Nation splashing all over his face. Later on, we have the Soul Train scene when everyone's dancing and then there's the blaxploitation. So the question is, like, does it all come together? And that's a question that each person sort of decides for himself or herself. And I thought, you know, it definitely did. But I thought it came together in a way that I kept thinking was almost seminar-like. One of the things he's trying to do is sort of correct historical narratives. And I do keep coming back, probably because I watched it, but I keep coming back to the importance of Birth of the Nation. It's notable toward the end, that scene where the Klan is watching Birth of the Nation. Meanwhile, the students from the black college and others are gathered
black power,
and
white power,
it's sort of a black power lecture being delivered by a character played by Harry Belafonte. I found that quite moving. But so we keep going back and forth from one group to the other, and that mirrors exactly what D.W. Griffiths did at the end of Birth of the Nation, when the heroic Klan is coming to rescue this town of Piedmont, South Carolina, from the clutches of the depraved and crazed blacks who have been unleashed upon them. And Spike sort of uses the same kind of juxtaposition and totally reverses, you know, the moral take on what these two groups stand for.
And so, I'm going to go back and say the idea that does this all come together and that came to you as you watch this is probably one of the main takeaways I think he wants the audience to come away from. Does this come together?
Yes. I just before we run out of time, I do want to say that
do we come together? Mm. You know,
yeah. Before we run out of time, I want to say that one of the things that he, if he's being didactic, if he's really trying to make us understand some things and correct for some things, I mean, he's very emphatic about the parallels between then and now, between the time this movie is set in and the present moment. The through line is David Duke, who is played by Topher Grace. I just want to play a little bit of his performance because I really do think it's one of the really remarkable things about this movie.
Today we are privileged to be among white men and white women, such as yourselves, real warriors for the real America, the America that our ancestors fought and died for, the true white American race, the backbone from whence came our great Southern heritage. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for never putting your country second. America first. America first. America first.
Where else have we heard that? So we're running out of time here, Rich. But and it's not only gets a spoiler to say at the end, Spike shows us the real David Duke, shows us contemporary footage from Charlottesville. And it's, I think there are going to be some people who say, I didn't have this reaction. There are going to be some people who say, that's a little overdetermined. You know, we probably could have figured all that out. You didn't have to show us actual news footage now in order to make sure that we understood that. I personally appreciated that. And I'm judging from your comments that since you didn't have any problem with any loose threads in this movie, it didn't bother you either.
No, that I think that was so absolutely necessary because we cannot drive that point home enough that when we abdicate our responsibilities, which was happening in this movie. There came a point where progress could have been made, you know, that they were at a point where a certain level of focus could have been put on the Klan and disrupted this whole supremacist movement in a substantial way and minimized it. And the powers to be, you know, where the power actually is in this country was able to stop that progress. You know, and that the inevitable change that came from that was not, you know, the Klan hiding in the woods burning crosses, but it's people running over other people in cars in the middle of the street in
all right,
crowds.
We are going to have to stop there. This is a fascinating discussion. I'd like it to go another hour. We got to have time for some recommendations.
Today's show was produced by the black Jonathan McPants pretending to be the white Jonathan McPants, and by me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is not here to make friends. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jerron. I don't know what his last name is. On Monday's show, we'll revisit our salute to butter. And now, back to Colin.
All right. I'm just worried that not everybody will get that joke, so I don't know how many people understand this, but Kellyanne Conway was asked this week on a national news program who the highest-ranking White House staffer is now, now that Omarosa is gone, and she said Jerron.
Yes.
She didn't know his last
Yes, she
name.
Did.
Seriously?
Yes,
yeah,
she did.
Yeah. She said, oh, Jerron. Yeah.
You know, like Oprah.
She said he's doing great work. Didn't know his last name.
I don't know what department he works for.
Where's Jerron Sid, exactly. Anyway, time to make some recommendations. Why don't we start over here with you, Rand?
I'm going to speak incredibly fast. 5-second self-promotion. On September 26th, I'm going to be doing a reading at the Mark Twain House. I'm going to be reading fiction set in Hartford. That's exciting for me. September 26th, that will happen. I want to recommend two Trinidadian writers. One is the late C.L.R. James, and particularly his book called Beyond a Boundary. C.L.R. James was a Marxist social critic. He was one of the founding figures of intellectuals of West Indian independence. But he wrote a book in 1960 called Beyond a Boundary, which is a memoir of cricket. And it's really about the sociology of cricket. It's great for people who love sports memoirs, but he really examines cricket as a sort of manifestation of British colonialism about which he is deeply ambivalent. It is a terrific book, Beyond a Boundary. The second Trinidadian-born writer is V.S. Naipaul, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist who died this past week. He's an extremely gloomy, even nihilistic novelist. One witty critic called him V.S. Nightfall. I would recommend two books. His greatest novel is called A Bend in the River. He was a person of Hindu Indian background. His take on colonial life and colonialism was very paradoxical. It's unclear whether he identified with the liberators or with the oppressors. That made a lot of people critical of his work. His early book, however, Miguel Street, is really a book about the life on the streets of Port of Spain, Trinidad. It's full of Caribbean voices, and it's full of music and of a kind of comedy that he later abandoned for a much darker and more nihilistic vision. So to get his entirety of his career, you could do no better than bookending it with those two books, Miguel Street and A Bend in the River, V.S. Naipaul.
All right, Tanisha Dugan, you're next.
I'm going to do something I don't often do, which is endorse myself in a performative way, because I don't do that as much as I used to. On Monday the 25th, I will be hosting a conversation with Tony nominee Robert Askins, who is the playwright of Hand to God. We'll be talking about Hand to God. We'll be talking about his new works. And I'll be talking and really sort of encouraging a conversation about what it means to create art in 2018. Who do we do it for? Why do we do it? Is it on the nose? Is it not? Yes, that was a pun, but not intended.
Mm-hmm. And this will be at Theaterworks?
And this is at Theaterworks on Monday,
the
25th. Join me. I want to hear from all of you as well as us. And then the second piece, I'm going to endorse this movie, which I sort of talked about a little bit earlier in our conversation, because I want to beat back this part of my femaleness that I think is awful. And I think we do it. And I think it actually is the reason why Hillary Clinton ultimately is not the president. I want to endorse Crazy Rich Asians. Why? Because my classmate from SUNY Purchase, Constance Wu, is the star. And typically my female self would deny that that's happening, would deny that she is succeeding in the way that she is. And I want to work against that devil inside of me. Please see it. And in the way that black people came out for Black Panther, all people of color should come out for Crazy Rich Asians. It is a rom-com that has nothing to do with being Asian, although it is filled with beautiful, wonderful Asian actors.
Awesome. All right. Rich Holland.
So I am going to recommend everybody go out and see again, if you haven't, a Spike Lee film, When the Levee Broke, Requiem in Four Acts. It's about the Hurricane Katrina and everything that possibly could go wrong there, and out of neglect and out of intentionality. It's derived from the title of the film is derived from this Delta Blues tune called "When the Levees Break" about the 27 Mississippi River flood. And when I take a look at those two components coming together, it echoes a lot of what we saw in Black Klansmen, this idea that if we don't treat inequity with a certain amount of urgency, it will escalate beyond our control.
All right. I'm going to – what I did was I tried to think of some people that I will listen to, will continue to listen to Aretha, but sort of – and nobody carries that torch because really nobody can do it. I'll mention quickly Patricia Renee, R-E-N-E-A. She is a self-identified country singer, a black singer-songwriter who was actually on our country music show recently, the song Heavenly in particular. That's about as close to Aretha as I could find. I'm out of time. I guess I've got a lot of other ones I wanted to talk about, but I think I have to stop. And besides Aretha singing. That's what